Hey everyone, it's me, Nate, to tell you more about a brand new podcast from Stoveleg Media and B&B Creative called Paradigm, where myself and John and Jamie from True Crime Cast have teamed up to create a season-long serial true crime podcast where we dive deep into one case per season. And this season was about the Lillilid murders, which took place back in 1997. Now, John and Jamie do all the talking. They wrote the thing. I produced the whole thing. And I'm really proud of how it turned out. I think it raises some very interesting questions about the case, not necessarily about the crime itself, because that was, for the most part, all solved. But the question really lies in whether justice was served and whether the proper sentences were carried out. Was this a satanic killing, actually, or did everyone kind of get caught up in the satanic panic of the late 90s and eventually put people in jail for significantly longer than maybe what they deserved? Maybe they do deserve it. That's the paradigm. That's the question that John and Jamie continue to talk about through this eight-part season. But I've got episode one for you to chew on a little bit. And if you want to go listen to the rest of the season, the entire first season of Paradigm is out now covering the Lillilid family murders. It starts with the crime and then eventually works into who, A, the victims were, because those are the most important people. But then it goes into who were the six kids from Pikeville, Eastern Kentucky, a little Ohio Valley action in there, that committed this crime. And it goes into their stories and then eventually about the trial and the punishments given out and a little bit of reflection afterwards. So here's episode one of Paradigm.
Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is a pretty drive. You ever been up this way before?
Yeah, this will take you from Knoxville to Johnson City.
Okay. Well, that makes sense, I guess, but that's a road you've traveled quite a bit.
Yep.
I think this is the rest stop, so Pain Hollow's got to be close.
Yeah, we're going to turn off right here.
While they were at a rest area on Interstate 81, a group of teenagers carjacked the family.
We believe, and I still believe, that it was satanic.
That's when they were carjacked and driven to Baileyton, where they were shot and left in a ditch.
A clarification made by the Supreme Court opens the possibility now of parole for two of the six people convicted in the Lillilid murders.
It could have been anywhere, it just happened to be here.
Every good story has three sides.
The prosecution, the defense, and the truth.
My name is Jamie Boggs.
And I'm John Bailey. And as a Tennessee native, I want to know what really went down in the place where I grew up. This is Paradigm.
On Sunday, April 6th, 1997, two 911 calls were placed in the vicinity of Baileyton, Tennessee. Both reported hearing gunshots in the area just off the interstate on a country road near Greenville. When police arrived, they found a complicated crime scene that raised more questions than it answered. Four bodies, a man, a woman, and two children, one male and one female child, were found lined up along a ditch with gunshot wounds that day on Pain Hollow Road. The adults were dead, but the children were hanging on. Later identified as siblings 6-year-old Tabitha and 2-year-old Peter, they fought for their lives after this incident. Tabitha would pass away shortly after arriving at the hospital, but Peter survived, although he was severely disabled. Police were able to quickly identify the victims of this crime. Tabitha and Peter's last name was Lillilid, and their parents were the adults at the scene, 34-year-old Vidar and 28-year-old Delfina. This crime and the pending litigation continues to weigh on the community in Greene County, Tennessee. Not only were the victims well-loved by all that knew them, but the safe, warm embrace of the knowledge that something like that could never happen here was quickly ripped away from this community in a brutal, violent murder and a panic that still echoes on the highways, as well as in the hollers that make up Eastern Tennessee.
Once police identified the victims of this horrendous crime, they immediately started searching for the individuals behind the attack. Police quickly noted that a vehicle had been stolen. Even though there was still a car, which was a blue Chevrolet Citation, on the scene, Police were able to identify the owner of that vehicle on site using the car's vehicle identification number. This led the police to a woman named Mary Castle. While this car did belong and was registered to Mary Castle as the owner, she didn't know where the car was. She also did not know where her son was. Her son was 20-year-old Joseph Reisner, and he had been gone for 2 days. She told police he likely took the car, and she listed off a few friends that may be with him. She was right, and then some. Joseph had indeed taken the car, and he was with 5 teenagers. Joseph's girlfriend, Karen Howell, who was 17, their friend Natasha Cornett, who was 18, Natasha's boyfriend, Dean Mullins, who was 17, their friend Crystal Sturgill, who was 18, and a young man that this group had only met days ago, 14-year-old Jason Bryant.
With some idea of who may have been in the missing 1987 Dodge van stolen from the Lilylids, please put out a BOLO for the vehicle as well as Joseph and his friends, thanks to Joseph's mother Mary. This is obviously before cell phones were widely available, before smartphones, and before 24-hour unlimited access to social media or the news. So logistically, it took a little more time to track people down back then. It was 2 days before we tracked down this van, and authorities were contacted by federal agents from Douglas, Arizona. Back in 1997, Americans did not need a passport to simply cross the border into Mexico, or Canada for that matter. There was a vehicle trying to cross over into America from Mexico. When the border officers ran the plates, the BOLO that had been put out on the Lilylids van alerted them that this van and the occupants were somewhere they shouldn't be. Also, there was a wounded person inside. 14-year-old Jason Bryant had an apparent gunshot wound. All 6 individuals in the van were taken into custody, and in just a few days, they would be extradited to Tennessee, where they were wanted for murder and grand theft auto. Authorities quickly started putting together a picture of what they thought happened. Karen Howell, Jason Bryant, Crystal Sturgill, Dean Mullins, Joseph Reisner, and Natasha Cornett were actually from Eastern Kentucky, specifically around the Pikeville area. They had traveled down Interstate 81 en route to New Orleans. Natasha had lived in New Orleans for a little while previously and was going to help everybody else get settled once they arrived. Authorities also noticed that the group was largely dressed in black, as was popular at the time in a style referenced then as goth. The group wore black, the girls wore dark makeup, and they put on the front that they were mysterious and complex. The deeper they dug, the more authorities started to form a narrative about what motivated this group to commit murder and then go on the run.
The 1990s were the peak of the movement now known as the Satanic Panic. It started back in the 1980s and largely revolved around the growing fear amongst the general public that satanic cults were growing all over the world and planning to commit mass murder in satanic rituals. Common beliefs were that these cults worshiped Satan in the woods. There were certain songs, particularly rock songs, that had hidden satanic messages, and that children all over the world were in danger both of corruption and being murdered by Satan worshipers. We are going to have an entire episode about the causes and impacts about the Satanic Panic later on, but it is important to note that the goth culture was often associated with satanic cults. And that quickly became the narrative around this group that was labeled by the media as Satan's Six. The police and later the prosecution went with the theory that these individuals left Pikeville, Kentucky, and decided to head towards New Orleans in a natural-born killers type of killing spree. In case you haven't heard of it, Natural Born Killers was a popular movie that came out in 1994 that showed a couple killing people for fun across the entire country. They were played by Woody Harrelson and Juliette Lewis. They were being chased down by Tommy Lee Jones, and even Robert Downey Jr. was in the movie as a journalist covering their crimes. It was a fun watch, but there were indeed several crimes perpetrated that were directly tied back to this film. We covered all of those copycat cases on an episode of True Crime Cast, and it's definitely worth a listen. But there did not seem to be a great deal of evidence showing that this group had ever seen the movie. Yes, they drove across the country, but they only killed once. They had several opportunities and did not kill again. So, it was not the most logical argument. But the prosecution certainly won over the public in sensationalizing this murder as a satanic ode to natural-born killers.
The Lilielid family, on the other hand, was on their way home to Knoxville. They had been at a conference for Jehovah's Witnesses in Johnson City. Their faith was a huge part of their lives, and them trying to share their faith played a role in the events to come. The Lilielids stopped off at a rest stop near mile marker 41 on Interstate 81. They were using the restrooms and consoling Peter, who again was 2 years old and had come down with an earache. The six from Kentucky were riding in a Chevy Citation, which only had 4 seats. And again, there were 6 of them. They had been stopped for speeding about an hour before arriving at this rest stop, but nobody had reported that the group was missing, so they were given a ticket and sent on their way. The car was not going to make it very far, it was overheating, and they knew it. They unsuccessfully tried to hotwire and steal some other cars, so at this rest stop, they were trying to find a better vehicle to help them get to New Orleans. Once they arrived at the rest stop, they were all roaming around, going to the restroom and visiting the vending machines. Joseph Reisner was off to himself smoking a cigarette when he noticed the Lilielid family. He had seen them pull in and thought about how much more room he would have if they got their hands on that van. Reisner was joined by Jason Bryant, and Vidar approached the two young men proselytizing. He was sharing his faith with them, and they played along for a while. They sat at a table, listening to Vidar try to convert them to his religion. In the meantime, Natasha Cornett and Karen Howell were still walking around, and Crystal Sturgill and Dean Mullins were in the back of the car. There was a witness at the rest stop named Karen Sinclair. She knew the Lilielids from the conference they had just attended, and this is what she wrote in her statement about what she saw at the rest stop, read by a voice actor.
I went to the Jehovah's Witness convention in Johnson City from 10 a.m. to 3:30 or 4, and then a group of us went to Grady's restaurant to eat. I did not see the Lilielid family at the restaurant. So after I got on I-81, I needed to go to the restroom. So I stopped at the first rest area on the right on I-81, and Kara, my 19-year-old, and myself went to the restroom. I had left my car running and left my son, Russ, who's 17 years old, and my daughter, Megan, she's 9, in the car. When I came out of the bathroom stall, Tabitha and Delphina were at the wash basin, and I talked to Delphina, and she seemed fine as we were walking out. I noticed the group of teenagers. They began moving like a herd towards Vidar's direction, but I didn't really think much of it at the time. I honked at Vidar and waved, and then we went on. My son told me that one of the kids had snapped around and stared at me, though, when I honked, but I did not see the Lilielids after this.
Reisner walked over to the car, grabbed a gun that they had stolen before leaving Pikeville. He walked back over to Bryant and Vidar and pulled the gun out. He ordered the entire Lilielid family to get in their van. The group drove their car as well, and they followed the Lilielid van out into a secluded road at the nearest exit along I-81. When they parked the cars, everyone there quickly realized something terrible was about to happen.
From this point, the details get kind of fuzzy. According to Jason Bryant, Joseph Reisner and Dean Mullins fired all the shots at the family. Seemingly, everyone else insisted that Jason Bryant was the one who acted as the lone shooter and used 2 different guns of different calibers to murder the family. The narrative at court suggested a satanic ritual killing. They stated that the bodies were placed in an upside-down cross at the scene. This would be disputed by all of the accused and even an investigator at the scene, and we'll hear more from him shortly. Regardless of who pulled the trigger and their motivation to do so, forensically the crime scene looked like this. The first shot was likely fired at Vidar, striking him in the right eye. He was almost definitely knocked unconscious and possibly even killed by that shot. However, he would be shot at least four more times while laying on the ground. He received wounds from both a 9mm and a 25 caliber pistol. Delfina Lilylid was shot eight times, with wounds coming from both weapons. She would have lived through most of the shots, seeing her husband and possibly even her children shot before she would pass away. Tabitha had been shot once in the head. Peter had been shot twice, once in the head behind his right ear, and it came out of his right eye, and once in the back from a small caliber gun. At least Tabitha and Peter, and possibly Delfina, were still alive when the six decided to flee the scene, likely after half an hour or so. They piled into the Lilylid van and left their car at the scene. Before they left, Joseph Reisner decided to inflict one more wound against the family. He took the van and drove over their bodies. When authorities arrived at the scene, their legs were crushed and had tire marks on them.
On the 25th anniversary of this crime, there was a memorial held for the Lilylid family. At this event were the first police officers that arrived on the scene, Jeff Morgan and Frank Waddell. This is what reporter Ashley Sharp, formerly of WJHL of Johnson City, had to say about her interaction with the officers.
When we interviewed the first two Greene County Sheriff's Office deputies to get to the scene, this came in, as you just mentioned, as a disturbance call. It, like you said, people shoot guns all the time in the country. They target practice. They shoot them for fun, for hunt, whatever the purpose. That is not an uncommon thing to hear, especially in Baileyton. If you're from the area, you pronounce it Belton, but it is spelled Baileyton. So that's not an uncommon thing for you to hear. And, you know, Frank Waddell and Jeff Morgan, that was the name of the two Greene County Sheriff's Department deputies. So when Waddell and Morgan got to Payne Hollow, they thought that it was going to be drunks. They said drunks shooting off guns. And what they came upon was this horrific scene. We interviewed Frank Waddell on the 25th anniversary. He was actually the person who said the prayer at the anniversary commemoration that they had there at the scene on that road. And he was in tears. I mean, you have to think, you know, this is a first responder. This is a police officer who's at the scene 25 years later of, you know, where he was the first person to come across this family massacred, you know? And so we gave him some space and, you know, I approached him and I just told him, you know, hey, what does it make you feel to be back here? You know, that's not somewhere you're going to frequent as a police officer. It's not a main road. I don't know if he had been back there. He might have, but, you know, it's a very, very rural, very kind of tucked away country road. And this was so powerful. What he said when we were standing there, he said, I can still see them laying there. It never leaves you. That's what he said. And he was looking into the ditch that's off the side of that road when he said that. And he just said, you know, it's something that you just have to deal with, you just have to move forward from it. But to hear him say, you know, I can still see them laying there, you know, that just like crushed my soul to hear him say that, you know? So when Waddell and Morgan got there, he again, you know, said what EMS has said, Peter was still alive. He didn't tell me that he saw Tabitha was alive, I guess because she wasn't making any type of noise or anything. Maybe they assumed that she was dead. But he said at first he didn't even see Peter. You know, Peter was, he was a baby. He was what, like 2 years old?
He was two
and Tabitha was six. So Peter was laying in the ditch and he didn't even see them at first. So, you know, you're getting these, you see these bodies and then you see this little baby, two years old, right? That's alive. So, you know, they say that obviously that's just something that you're not ever going to get over. And just such a shocking and horrifying thing to come upon as a deputy in Greene County. And you made a good point. It's like, this doesn't happen here. You know, like every town says that, but like this really doesn't happen in Greene County. Like it just doesn't. It doesn't really happen that often in Northeast Tennessee. So, you know, it was just one of those, like you said, that a community just doesn't forget.
Authorities talked about Satan as much as possible when referring to these six individuals charged with the murder with the press. In Tennessee, right near the buckle of the Bible Belt, that hit really hard in the community. The six would request a change of venue due to the coverage in the area, and ultimately that request would be granted, and they decided instead of moving the trial, they would bus in jurors from the town of Cleveland, Tennessee. It's probably of note that Cleveland, Tennessee is the headquarters for the National Organization of the Church of God, so maybe that was not the most neutral of areas to pull jurors from when prosecuting an alleged group of Satanists. Judge Eddie Beckner made that decision. He also reportedly refused the request for the defendants to have separate trials. He said that giving each person their own trial could literally bankrupt all of Greene County.
Alas, this case would never go to trial. It was settled during jury selection. From the jump, District Attorney Berkeley Bell said that he wanted to go for the death penalty. There were Satan 6 signs everywhere in town, and burn in hell chants happened outside the courthouse. All signs pointed to a guilty verdict for all. So the pressure for a plea deal was palpable from the very beginning. Berkeley Bell shared that the group had stayed at the Collie Motel in Pikeville, Kentucky the night before the murders, doing drugs, drinking alcohol, and even worshiping Satan. He claimed that the group left the room with a burned 666 in the carpet of the hotel, but no proof of that claim ever surfaced. The group all got attorneys, mostly public defenders, and their attorneys went to work rather quickly. Natasha Cornett accepted a pro bono offer from Pikeville attorney Eric C. Kahn. Kahn was most well known as a disability attorney and not a criminal one. And he would later get in trouble for fraud, cheating the government out of over $500 million. He was arrested at a Pizza Hut in Honduras. It was a whole thing, but that's a story for another time. Kahn advised Natasha to lean into the Satan worship narrative in hopes of successfully entering an insanity plea. She referred to herself as the daughter of Satan in public, and Judge Beckner was asked to accept an insanity plea. Beckner thought this was a bad idea and saw through the scheme. He had Kahn removed and replaced as Natasha's attorney, but to the general public, the one from which the jury would be selected, the damage was done. Natasha Cornett, Joseph Reisner, Crystal Sturgill, and Dean Mullins were over 18 and were undoubtedly going to be charged as adults. Jason Bryant and Karen Howell were ages 14 and 17 respectively. They could have potentially been tried as minors, but given the graphic nature of the crime and the fact that Bryant was most likely to have actually fired one of the fatal shots, they were allowed to be sentenced and charged as adults. While the death penalty was off the table for the two of them, this meant the death penalty was on the table for the other four defendants.
District Attorney Berkeley Bell was very public about his pursuit of the death penalty for all involved. That made it even more appealing when he offered a plea deal. This deal would only apply if all six defendants agreed to it. Bell offered to take the death penalty off the table if everybody pled guilty to first-degree murder. They would all receive life sentences without the possibility of parole. In order to receive this deal, the group had 72 hours to sign their individual plea agreements. You may ask yourself why the two minors would sign this agreement. They would actually stand a good chance of a lesser sentence if they went to trial. According to Karen, she was essentially asked if she was willing to let Crystal Sturgill die despite her lack of apparent involvement in the murders. In fact, the whole group was pressured to sign their guilty pleas under the threat of one of their friends or many of their friends dying. With much hesitation, everyone would eventually sign this plea agreement.
We will dig deeper into the legal proceedings later on in this season, but as it stands, all six defendants of this case are still in prison. They have all filed a variety of appeals and petitions for relief. At the time of this recording, they have all been denied each and every time. But some believe that there is hope on the horizon for some members of the group, referred to one time as Satan Six, to get out of prison. On this season of Paradigm, we plan to discuss the Satanic Panic's impact on this case and other notable criminal cases across the country, the tangled web of never-ending legal proceedings for the defendants, and the upcoming litigation that could see some of them set free. From B&B Creative, this is Paradigm.
Thanks everyone for checking out that first episode of Paradigm, again available wherever you listen to your podcasts. All 8 episodes are out right now. If you like it and you like supporting me and Stoveleg Media and John and Jamie over at True Crime Cast, it would be huge if we can get this on the top podcast charts. We're trying to do that here on launch. So if you like it, go leave it a 5-star review and subscribe and do all of those good things if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And if not, just tell your friends about it. That goes a long way. That's how we built this. We built it just organically, a grassroots growth here at Stoveleg, an igniting conversation, and that's what we're trying to do. So again, go check out Paradigm. That's Paradigm, wherever you listen to podcasts.